Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, June 19th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from WCAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll hear from Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, Cindy McCormick at the Cape Cod Times, Jessica Hill also at the Cape Cod Times, and we'll speak with WCAI Sam Houghton. A lot to talk about. We're going to start with a rolling rally on the South Coast yesterday. WCAI's Jeanette Barnes was there to cover it and joins us to talk about this and other news from the week. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, good morning, Steve.
Jeanette, this rally yesterday in New Bedford was a little different from the rallies happening in recent weeks, though it does have overlaps. Tell us who organized it and what it was about.
Right. So this one was organized by a citizens group called Bristol County for Correctional Justice. They have opposed Sheriff Hodgson, the Bristol County Sheriff, for a long time, and they disagree with his politics and, they say, with his treatment of people in the jail. So yesterday they hosted two things, both a rolling caravan type protest with cars in a line going through New Bedford and Dartmouth, past the Dartmouth jail complex. And they also had simultaneously a demonstration in downtown New Bedford with sign holding and things like that and some speakers. So as you mentioned, this is not the same sort of group that's been hosting protests, although they do have some interests in common. The leadership of Bristol County for Correctional Justice, the most visible leaders tend to skew older and white. So that also is a little bit of a difference. But there were Black Lives Matter signs at the event. And I think a lot of people from Black Lives Matter were there supporting them as well. And then at the end of the demonstration, the Correctional Justice folks marched up to the big corner in New Bedford where the Black Lives Matter protests have taken place and participated in theirs. So they were supporting one another.
This comes about a week after a story came out about the sheriff and a picture of him wearing a tie that's been linked to Confederate tie representation. Can you tell us a little bit about that story and what the implications are here? Because some of the speakers mentioned this at the rally yesterday.
Yes, and there was definitely some imagery in the signs. So last week, they started trying to bring attention to a photo portrait of Hodgson wearing a tie that they say is a Confederate flag motif. And so it's not an image of the flag itself, but it is the blue, it has blue diagonal stripes with white stars on a red background. So it's similar. Hodgson's response to that is that this photo was on his website in 2003. He bought it in a store, not online, where now it's sold online, actually as a Confederate tie. But he says that he bought it in a store. He did not see it that way. He saw it as patriotic, red, white, and blue. And, of course, he denies any kind of sympathy with white supremacy. And he says this group is essentially politically motivated because he's conservative. He's a Trump supporter. He also participates in the 287G immigration program, where he cooperates with federal immigration authorities and detains immigrants. The group strongly opposes that.
So the group yesterday was also pointing to Hodgson's ties with Trump and President Trump and how he's working for President Trump's reelection. In fact, Hodgson was in Washington just recently, and had a photo opportunity with President Trump. And they were sort of saying that also he's like that trip to Washington was financed by taxpayer dollars.
Yes, yes. And he does not deny that. He says, yes, it was financed by taxpayer dollars as part of his job. But he says that he also did that during the Obama administration because it's part of the job. He definitely has been photographed a lot more in various Rose Garden ceremonies and things with President Trump. But he says it's all part of being sheriff.
And just his response overall to yesterday's rolling rally and these calls for him to resign is that this is all political and these are just political accusations. Is that right?
Essentially, yeah. I mean, he kind of characterizes it as the left against him, you know.
I want to look at another story you reported this week. The state announced that it reached a settlement with the company that has purchased the Pilgrim nuclear plant for decommissioning. Tell us what we know about what the settlement addresses. This has been kind of a long time in the making.
Right. So this settlement resolves three things that the state of Massachusetts had pending against the transfer of a federal license to Holtec from Entergy. It resolves the two lawsuits and a petition the state had to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. What it does not do is resolve a similar petition by the local watchdog group, Pilgrim Watch. But the settlement is trying to ensure that the decommissioning will have enough protections for human health, for the environment, and also that the company has enough money to do it right.
Right. So some of the things that this settlement sets forth, I know, are there's the more strict adherence to guidelines around safety and cleanup and monitoring. Essentially, the state has more strict guidelines than the federal government on these, or the NRC on these, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And so the state has now gotten Holtec to agree that they will adhere to the more strict guidelines. And then also it has to do with keeping some money aside to make sure that there's enough there for the entire cleanup, right?
Right. Yep.
And then you spoke to Mary Lampert, who is with Pilgrim Watch, an activist group, and she's part of the case, as you said, that isn't resolved by this settlement. What did she say about what she thought of the state settlement?
Well, she says mostly that she's still digesting it. It's 40 pages. She understands everything is kind of a negotiation and the give and take. And I think she very much appreciates, she said, what the state and the attorneys have done in this case to get what they have gotten. But she said she's not sure if it really does everything that Pilgrim Watch wants. And so they're kind of, at the moment, they're kind of reserving judgment, she says. They have no, well, she did want to point out that they do not have any immediate plans to drop their own petition to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Turning to some coronavirus news this week, the Cape Cod Reopening Task Force announced this week that it is expanding testing across the region. Tell us what they have in mind here.
Right. So they are going to be creating a mobile testing unit that can go to businesses or other places, facilities that have had a coronavirus exposure or case, and try to test people there to make testing more available at different locations.
At the same time, it sounds like they're going to be moving from their drive-through site at the Four Seas, where they've been ever since this sort of pandemic started, and they started testing at Four Seas. They're going to be doing some testing at their Hyannis campus and then also in Falmouth.
They are going to be opening a testing site at Falmouth Hospital, yes.
And they're also the reopening task force now is providing signage for businesses to help them cope with the summer and letting people know what the expectations are around things like social distancing and wearing masks. Tell us about what they're doing with this.
Right. So they have in an effort to provide as many resources for businesses as they can for reopening, they have some links to printable signs on their website with a variety of different COVID-19 safety messages. And what's interesting is they've allowed for the fact that some businesses want to be a lot more blunt than others with that information. So depending on the tone that someone wants to take, they have everything from some friendly cartoon characters and the signs to just say, go big on distancing. And then they, in a very small print, they have some stuff about on that sign about staying 6 feet apart. But the overall message is very friendly. And then they have other signs that say, no shirt, no shoes, no mask, no service.
There's another issue around this that we've been talking about, which is that the state officially is asking people to quarantine for 14 days when they come here. But that message seems to be falling a little bit to the wayside in the enthusiasm for summer and summer business. Is that still a message that that's being sent to people coming from out of state?
Well, this is a sticky one. So officially, the 14-day quarantine request is still in effect. I asked Senator Julian Sear of the task force about that issue and what does it really mean? What do people have to do? He said, sometimes people mistake the word quarantine for isolation. And he believes that quarantine means vigilant social distancing. So I asked, does that translate into being able to show up at the grocery store with a mask on during the 14 days? His response to that was to refer me to the State Department of Public Health. So I think it really is a squishy area where people know that if we had a true isolated quarantine under the dictionary definition of quarantine for 14 days, that people might not be able to come here on vacation. So, you know, this sort of thread of personal responsibility and decision making has gone through a lot of the social distancing period, that people are kind of trying to decide what's reasonable to request and what's reasonable to do.
I want to talk about another story, and for this I want to bring in WCAI's Eve Zuckoff, who's going to join us on the line. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Today, June 19th, is a day known as Juneteenth, and there are gatherings in recognition of this planned across the region and across the country. Jeanette, you spoke to somebody about what this day means and where it comes from, somebody with a local connection. Tell us what we learned about Juneteenth there.
Yes, so the Emancipation Proclamation declared the slaves of the South free during the Civil War in 1863, but in some places it couldn't be enforced until the war ended in 1865. So in some places, and notably in Texas, African Americans were enslaved for an extra 2.5 years. June 19th, in 1865, the day that Union troops arrived in Galveston, Texas, to announce to the community that slaves were free. And essentially since that date, it has had it has been celebrated in the South and in Texas with things like barbecues and parades and things like that. It's not as well known. It's not universally known in this area. But I think it's probably safe to guess that social media has helped with that over the last few years.
And definitely this year, coming after these rallies that we've seen and the commemorations, the recognition of the after the death of George Floyd, Juneteenth has a different energy this year. Eve, I know that you're planning on covering a Juneteenth event later today. Tell us where you'll be and what that looks like now.
Yeah, that's right. So later today at 1 o'clock, there will be a March for Equality on Martha's Vineyard, and it starts at Veterans Park, and there will be speeches at Ocean Park at 3:30. But it's really all across the region. At 3:30, there will be a celebration, and as Jeanette says, it's more of a collaborative art project. This one seems very festive, actually, in the Market Basket Plaza near the Sagamore Bridge off Route 6. And then, you know, again, kind of going back to the more thinking about the moment that we're in, at the Unitarian Church of Barnstable, they will host a Juneteenth standout for racial justice at 5 o'clock tonight. So yeah, I mean, and first of all, as Jeanette says, these are all kind of traveling through social media, and that's how people are finding out about a lot of these. And unlike other years, it'll be, you know, so there will be some celebration, but I think there will also be a real sense of mourning this year.
You are listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. WCAI's Jeanette Barnes, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
And Eve Zuckoff, you're going to stay with us so that we can talk about a couple more stories on the other side. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We'll have more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. With us is WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. This week, the state modified its guidelines for day camps and child care centers to reopen. This was in response to really a loud outcry against the previous rules. Eve, what do the new rules say? What have we heard from the state?
Yeah, so now there are a couple of modifications. So now children older than age 2 are encouraged but no longer required to wear face masks. They will still be expected to be socially distant, but they now also won't be subjected to a temperature check before entering their daycare or summer camp. Every single day before entering, though, of course, parents will still have to fill out a daily survey, kind of explaining, you know, here's how my kid is doing at home. We have no symptoms, you know, things like that. Also, now this was a big one, I think, for many daycare operators. Classroom sizes, they're still limited to 10 children and one teacher per group, but now one teacher can kind of float between groups to provide that extra support because it is a high-pressure job. And the state has emphasized we want to minimize as much as possible an adult floating between groups, but we recognize, you know, programs need to be able to establish their own staffing patterns based on their own unique needs.
And when you speak to daycare operators, what do you hear them saying about what these changes could mean and what the guidelines overall are going to mean for them?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think the revision specifically, I've heard from them, this means, okay, the state is listening. They've been willing to engage with the call for revisions, 35,000 people who signed a petition saying these guidelines just won't really work for us. But they also say that these guidelines overall, even with the revisions, are still almost impossible to imagine how they really could be done. So I spoke with one woman, Cindy Horgan, the executive director of Cape Cod Children's Place in Eastham, and she said, you know, when you have a three-year-old that needs to be comforted and we're told we can't necessarily touch them all the time, just from a developmental place, that's not a good thing. And even just the expectation that 2 and 3 year olds are going to be able to be placed in separate hula hoops, 10, you know, 6 feet apart, and not engage with each other, not touch each other, is just not super realistic to anyone who has worked with kids in this way. And the biggest issue to them that I've heard financially is really the idea of enrollment. This idea that if you can't have groups of more than 10 children together at a time, that means you're going to have to limit your enrollment. And that tuition, these are not money-making operations necessarily in many cases. So you're losing tuition while you're paying more for cleaning supplies. And so a lot of these businesses are feeling really squeezed. They just don't feel like these guidelines really work for them, what their real business is.
That is WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
Next year, there will be only one kindergarten class in Chatham Elementary School. It's indicative of an ongoing decline in school enrollments around the region. Tim Wood joins us from the Cape Cod Chronicle with the story. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, this continuing drop in enrollment has all kinds of implications for staffing and for the future of the school and for how Chatham shares school costs with Harwich and even for the health of the town, some people say. Tell us more about what's happening here.
It sure does. It's been a topic of conversation for almost 2 years here in town. Specifically, the enrollment at the elementary school, it's been going down for several years. The incoming kindergarten class has gone from 3 classes a few years ago to 2 and now 1 this coming September. Though there were only 11 local kids who signed up for kindergarten, and the school department opened the class up for school choice, and they were able to get 6 Harwich, mostly Harwich kids to come in to make up the class of to get it to 17 or so kids, which is the optimal class size that the district has. Now, if this trend continues, and it's looking like it will, because the preschool class also for next year is down, and they've cut that from 2 sessions to 1. The Monomoy District, of course, has 2 elementary schools, 1 in Chatham and 1 in Harwich. The Harwich Elementary School is much larger. Right now it has about 550 students compared to 200 in Chatham. And when you look at the fixed cost of running a school, it costs more than $14,000 to educate a student in Chatham versus about $11,000 in Harwich. And with the current school funding formula in the district, Chatham pays 25% of that cost and Harwich pays a little over 74%. So So essentially, Harwich is subsidizing Chatham's elementary school. And because that formula is based on enrollment, Harwich's share is just going to be going up in the future. And that's, you know, Harwich is already calling for budget cuts because their education costs have escalated. And Superintendent of Schools Scott Carpenter said, you know, at some point there's going to have to be a reconciling of this. He's not calling for that right away, but he said, you know, that the towns and the school officials need to look at this and really address it. You know, the current district agreement requires that each town has a separate elementary school. And a couple of years ago, there was a proposal to change that agreement to give some flexibility to the district in aligning the school grades so that they might have, say, you know, redistrict the schools so that more Harwich kids went to Chatham or some other system. But Chatham shot that down. Chatham wants its own elementary school. And the schools are going to have to figure out how to handle this, Scott Carpenter said, as that enrollment situation continues.
Tim, I want to ask you really quickly about the town meetings that are coming up. In our new way of doing things, they're going to be outside, which doesn't sound too bad as long as the weather cooperates. Tell us what's in store there,
sure,
real briefly.
Yeah, Saturday, tomorrow at 10, Orleans voters are going to gather behind in the field behind Nauset Middle School. They'll have space for about 550 socially distanced voters, and they'll be addressing a 47-article meeting, town meeting warrant. If the weather does not look good, they will postpone it either till later in the day or another date. And then we've got Chatham's town meeting coming up on Monday at 6 p.m. at Veterans Field, where they also will be having the chairs distanced for voters. And Chatham has taken a little different tack. They're going to move about 13 or 14 articles into a consent calendar where there'll be one vote on those articles. And all the petition articles that were on the warrant are going to be put off until a September special town meeting. And kind of the main focus of this meeting, which other than the budgets, was going to be a controversial measure to choose between two different sites for a senior center. Those articles also will be put off for September. So basically, we'll be dealing with about 13 or 14 financial articles that need to be addressed at this town meeting. Town moderator Bill Litchfield says he thinks it'll take about an hour. And there is a rain date of Tuesday if the weather turns bad on Monday.
It's Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
A low voter turnout on Nantucket for town election this week. Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror joins us now to talk about this and other stories. Hiya, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, tell us, turnout barely topped 20%, it looks like.
It did, 20.1%, actually. 1,860 of the island's 9,250 registered voters cast ballots on Tuesday. 519 of them actually voted early, so less than 1,300 people showed up at the polls. Annual town election turnout on Nantucket has not been stellar over the last decade anyway. Turnout has fluctuated only between 22 and 35%, but this is the lowest that it's been in quite some time. Incumbent Jason Bridges and former school committee member Melissa Murphy were elected to the select board in the only contested race on the ballot that might have had something to do with it. Former finance committee member Clifford Williams, making his eighth run for the board, finished third and out of the running. Incumbent Rita Higgins chose not to seek re-election. Voters also approved a couple of ballot questions, one of them authorizing a $5 million permanent annual override to fund the town-run nursing home. And also they authorized the repair of the Children's Beach stormwater pump station. They turned down a couple of roadwork proposals. The approved questions must still be okayed by town meeting. Nantucket's town meeting is going to be held indoors, socially distanced, next Thursday. And in a similar fashion, it's also going to be a pared-down meeting with basically only financial articles. And those ballot question articles are not actually even going to be discussed. They're going to be put off until a special town meeting or the following annual town meeting as well.
Hey, you have another story in the paper this week about lifeguards and how they're sort of re-envisioning summer in the pandemic. Give us a sense of what that's about.
Sure. They're actually anticipating a busier summer than usual, with fewer recreational opportunities available to vacationers and islanders alike. They're preparing to be quite busy with a lot more people on the beach, they think, and obviously the pandemic is also changing the way they operate. Beach rescues will look different. They will make every effort they can to minimize contact. They're going to use flotation tubes and rescue lines when they can to assist people in distress. They'll use a bag valve mask if they have to perform CPR. But if an emergency situation dictates contact, they're going to make contact to make sure they get the rescue done, said Sheila Lucy, the town's harbor master who runs the program. They're going to do the best they can to prevent exposure, but saving lives comes first, she said. They will do whatever they need to get done, and then when the situation has resolved itself, they will circle back and ask some coronavirus-related questions regarding exposure, symptoms, that kind of thing.
I want to ask you, too, about the vigil that was held Friday night on Main Street. It drew quite a crowd.
Drew over 500 people. This is the second organized protest on the island in the last month following the death of George Floyd. And on Friday's protest, again, about 500 or more people were there to commemorate the lives of black men and women killed in the last decade nationwide by police. It was organized, as the previous one was, by former and current Nantucket High School students, and this time also by Unitarian Church Reverend Linda Simmons. One of the organizers, a young woman who graduated from Nantucket High School in 2017, Keisha Blois, called it a starting point to address racial inequity. The first step, she said, is to show up and listen to people of color in your community. The second is to educate yourself on police brutality and systemic racism, not only how it affects the island but the rest of the country. But it goes further than that, said Brittany Anderson, who was another one of the young organizers. It really needs to involve hiring more people of color to positions of authority across the board in the town, including the school system, the government, and the police force, she said. The select board is going to be addressing this. They're looking at creating a task force made up of town officials and community members to address and to educate about racial inequity on the island.
That is Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Harbor cruises and whale watches are still suspended as a result of the pandemic, but the companies that offer them are taking steps to be ready for when they can resume with the next phase of reopening. Marianne Bragg joins us from the Provincetown Banner with the story. Hi, Marianne.
Hey there. How are you?
Marianne, a number of these companies operate from McMillan Pier in Provincetown. Tell us how many there are and what kinds of steps they're going to have to take.
Well, McMillan Pier, it's the one town-owned pier in Provincetown, and there are seven companies that fall under what's really an emergency order that was issued by the Select Board and the Board of Health on June 1st. And that's over and above what Governor Baker has said for the phase three. And so these seven tenants, they're the Whale Watch Company and like harbor cruises that go around the harbor and take people out for sunset cruises. Those companies have to basically provide a COVID-19 safety plan on how they're going to handle various aspects of their business. And then that plan has to be approved by the Board of Health before they're allowed to operate, specifically before they're allowed to use the docking facilities at the pier.
How big is this business for Provincetown, all these different cruises that operate from there? This is a big part of the summer business there.
Well, let's see. I don't actually have a firm number on the Provincetown numbers. We were able to ask the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce about whale watching across the region, and that includes Provincetown, like Barnstable, even Plymouth. And the Wendy Northcross had said that across the region that about 5,000 people per day are transported out to Stellwagen Bank to look at whales, basically, on the whale watch trips. So that's one number. But maybe more generally, I would say that the influx of people to whale watching and these harbor cruises, it literally brings, you know, thousands of people right into the center of town. And that's right in the center of town is where so many small businesses are there, whether it's food or sweatshirts or T-shirts or jewelry or, you know, everything else. So I think So the town of Provincetown, it really, I think, means a lot to the small business people, particularly right there in the center of town.
So what dates, hi dog, what dates are they looking at for potentially reopening these cruises?
So the Governor Baker, so the earliest that the Whale Watch and the Harbor Cruises could go out would be on Monday the 29th, and that would be at the earliest for phase three. So all of the safety plans have to be kind of approved by then. And I think that's what people are really counting on, that it's going to happen on the 29th.
And all of this, of course, is contingent on the virus response continuing to seem like we're in control of the virus response now that the numbers continue to decline.
That's true. You know, I forgot to mention that. But like Provincetown right now has, I think at least as of Monday, zero, you know, active cases of COVID-19. But that's one thing the Board of Health chairman had told these peer companies is that, you know, even if we open up to phase three, if they're allowed to go out, even if they go all the way to phase four, that there's always the chance that if the coronavirus cases start to arise, particularly in the town, not just on the statewide, but in Provincetown, then those businesses would really, you know, the phases could be rolled back and the companies might have to close, at least temporarily.
That is Marianne Bragg from the Provincetown Banner joining us with the story about harbor cruises and whale watches as they try to ramp up during the pandemic. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Welcome back. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. This week, the state announced free coronavirus testing at a number of sites. It happened Wednesday and Thursday. From the Cape Cod Times, Cindy McCormick has this story. Hi, Cindy.
Good morning.
Cindy, this was in response to the recent rallies and protests over the death of George Floyd, right?
Yeah, there were so many people gathering in large groups, and Senator Julian Sear, Democrat Ron Truro, and other legislators asked the Baker-Polito administration if they would take several actions in the wake of the protests. And one of them was this free universal testing that was at 50 sites across Massachusetts, including four here on Cape Cod, the CVS clinic in East Falmouth, and three of the Outer Cape Health Services sites. Harwichport ramped up, and they had more than about 600 people the first day, and the two other locations, Wellfleet and Provincetown, had about 200 each. So that's 1,000, and they expected the same yesterday.
It seems like a remarkable effort to provide free testing for that many people in these sites. How will people be notified as the testing comes through?
Well, they will get a phone call and a letter, and probably the ones who are positive will be notified first. It won't be until next week. And note, this isn't just free. This is for people who are asymptomatic, too. You didn't have to have any signs and symptoms. And the thinking behind that is that if you can identify people who are positive and don't know it, then you can contain the virus because they'll be isolating. So the whole idea behind this sort of universal testing, which hasn't really happened yet. Now, Martha's Vineyard, you may know, is getting universal testing because the head of Quest Diagnostics lives over there and is collaborating with island officials to offer it to everybody. And here on Cape Cod, there's also a place called Whole Health Pharmacy in Hyannis, which has a federal grant to offer free testing as well.
You cover this for the Cape Cod Times, testing and the medical response to the coronavirus. It seems like we have seen now a steady downturn in coronavirus cases across the region. What's the feeling as you're covering it?
Yeah, the cases, you know, cases continue to rise, but hospitalizations are going down, deaths are going down. It looks like all the signals are good, all the markers indicate that this isn't a downward trend. But there's a lot of concern about keeping this in a downward trend, especially, you know, as the Cape opens up and the islands open up to tourists. And, you know, Boston has been such a hot spot. Of course, New York has been such a hot spot. So there's really this feeling, you know, that, you know, wear masks, wash your hands, socially distance when possible, you know, the 6 feet apart. And also just this testing, Julian Sear mentioned yesterday in a briefing that was for the reopening of Cape Cod Task Force. He said the goal is to get 20% of the population on Cape Cod tested for the active virus. That's the molecular PCR test for the active virus. And so far, he said it's just been about 6.6%. And right now, different locations like Cape Cod Healthcare is offering the testing, and Outer Cape Health is going back to offering the testing for people who are screened, and it won't be free. But the issue with that is that you have to get a screening through a doctor, whereas if you go through, for instance, Whole Health Pharmacy, you basically can just say, I want the test. And but now their appointments are filling up. I mean, there's a demand for this. There's like people want to know if they have the illness, and people also want to know if they're carrying the virus. And like I said, it's part of the containment because, yeah, you could have a test today that shows that you're negative today and you could be positive tomorrow. But in the meantime, if you are positive and you don't know it, then you can isolate and that will prevent it from spreading further.
It seems remarkable that there was that kind of turnout for these tests this week. When you talk about 1,000 in Harvardsport, yeah, really, that people are anxious to have an opportunity to find out if they've been exposed to this.
Yeah, people are very anxious, and they said that, it was very smooth traffic flow there in Harwichport. They said they got the most because, of course, they're drawing from people from, the midsection of the Cape and not just the outer Cape. And they said they work with the Harwich police and volunteers with some 13 volunteer people to keep the traffic running. And they were just, they were running about, I think, 11 hours a day or something. It just had this constant steady stream of people coming. As a matter of fact, the CEO of Outer Cape Health Services said, people booked appointments, but then there were so many that some officials had to run out to a Quest facility and get more tests because they just weren't expecting that many. They knew there would be a lot, but they weren't expecting that many.
That is Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times joining us with that story. Cindy, thanks for being with us.
Okay. Have a great day.
16 years ago, Lewis Matthews of Mashpee was arrested on suspicion of murder. He was eventually tried and convicted by an all-white jury. Matthews, who is black, maintains his innocence, and his family is protesting his conviction, saying race played a part in it. Jessica Hill joins us from the Cape Cod Times with the story. Hi, Jessica.
Hello.
Jessica, the family here, including Lewis Matthews' son, we're standing out at Mashpee Rotary this week to call attention to this case. Tell us more about the details here.
Right. So Matthew's family and some of his relatives and friends all gathered around the Mashpee Rotary on Monday to protest his incarceration and to demand for his release or new trial. Matthews was convicted in 2005 after Scott Turner, one of his friends, was actually found dead in a Ninegret Avenue yard. He was found, he had been beaten with a blunt object multiple times, and his pockets were turned inside out and his shoes were tied together. Matthews was the immediate suspect because he had been out the night before drinking and kind of hanging out all day the day before. They were kind of drinking, partying, and barbecuing. Because he was the last person to be seen with him, and because his family claims that because he is black, police narrowed in on him as the only suspect. Since then, they have been trying to get a new trial, and but because of they argue that he has no motive and that no DNA evidence ties him to the crime. Lynn Raymond, who is kind of leading this case or leading this investigation and trying to argue for her cousin's innocence, she argues that blood tests were inconclusive, meaning that blood that was found around Matthews at the time is inconclusive and does not either confirm or deny the blood belonging to Scott Turner, who is the victim. Mm.
One of the things that the family is saying here is that the case is representative of really a systematic injustice of racism within the legal system.
Right. So they argue that certain pieces of the trial never came through, pieces that could kind of show Matthew's innocence. There are pieces of evidence that were not in the call log or the kind of report of where everything is being kept. A couple of things are missing from the chain of custody report. And they also argue that certain things such as like third party culpability was never brought up in court, and that could have also exonerated him. They argue that because of, from the beginning, they argue that the trial was incorrectly managed and that the investigation was narrowing in on him, they claimed that it was a form of procedural police brutality. While, you know, he was not, you know, shot down in the street like many other or like some of these other cases that we're seeing, they argue that he was kind of a victim of this procedural injustice in the justice and criminal systems.
What happens next for Matthews?
So right now, his case is gaining a little bit of traction. He was scheduled in November to have a motion hearing for a new trial, but that had been postponed after Matthews' attorney resigned. Matthews and his family had asked him to resign as they did not think that he was doing an adequate job representing him. And now the Committee for Public Counsel Services, they have an innocence program that is starting to look into Matthews' case. Raymond, who is his cousin, just sent them a copy of the court transcripts, and they also hired a private investigator, but that investigator cannot start until they get a new lawyer assigned to the case.
Jessica Hill from the Cape Cod Times talking about the case of Lewis Matthews of Mashpee. Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Voters turned out in numbers in Oak Bluffs and Edgartown yesterday wearing masks and maintaining social distance. Noah Asimo from the Vineyard Gazette has election results for us. Hi, Noah.
Hey, Steve.
A different kind of election altogether.
Yeah, totally. Voters were greeted with long lines and a lot of hand sanitizer when they showed up to the polls this week. You know, this was the first election on island since the pandemic had started, and so this is the first time that town clerks were dealing with any of the necessary social distancing protocols. Everything appeared to go smoothly, except for in Edgartown, the voting machine actually malfunctioned for a little bit just because they were using so much hand sanitizer in the ballot boxes that it was wetting the ballots, and the machine was rejecting them. But the results were exciting. In Oak Bluffs, Brian Rooley, who is he's a police officer in Edgartown, but lives in Oak Bluffs. He ended up unseating an incumbent selectman, Mike Santoro, and Brian Pakish, who is an incumbent selectman, ended up winning as well. So there were two seats available there. And then in Edgartown, the incumbent selectman, Margaret Serpa, she kind of eked out a victory over a young challenger, Juliette Molinaire. So yeah, it was a fun day for elections on the island, and there was a good turnout too.
And then there are a number of issues that were on the ballot as well, you know, especially some with financial implications. Tell us a little bit about those.
Yeah. So the biggest one was probably the Oak Bluffs town hall question. The town has a deteriorating town hall, and they've tried twice before to pass a town hall remodel, renovation, and demolition plan. At both times, it's been approved at town meeting, but because it involves a debt exclusion, it needs to also get approved at the ballot box. And both times previously, it had failed. But this, the third time, proved to be the charm this round, and the project was approved, you know, pretty strongly, actually, at the ballot box. I think the vote ended up being 500 to 338. And so the town can get started with that. And it's a $13.3 million plan. And it shows you how I think town sentiment changed over time. You know, even with all the sort of financial restrictions because of coronavirus, voters still turned out to approve the town hall plan. And then in Edgartown, there were a bunch of spending questions, and they were all approved, including one that will allow the town to sort of trade easements for a piece of land and allow the Boys and Girls that the Boys and Girls Club is using for an expansion. So yeah, there were a lot of exciting developments on that regard, too.
That is Noah Asimo from the Vineyard Gazette updating us on election results from yesterday. Hey, Noah, thanks for that.
Thank you, Steve.
Just what can you do this summer for entertainment that gets you out of the house on a weekend night? Well, drive-in theaters are making a comeback fast and furious. WCAI Sam Houghton joins us with an update on the drive-in likely to be popping up near you. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Sam, how many of these are we looking at by your count so far?
Yeah, I've counted six so far, and they're all kind of in varying stages. But yeah, Dreamland on Nantucket, they announced they'll have a series this summer. They're open. They're hoping to start in July, early July. Then there's the Zyterian Theater, New Bedford. They're actually having live concerts and movies at their drive-in. The Heritage Theater in Sandwich, their grand opening is planned for next Friday. Funny you should mention Fast and the Furious is their number one, is their opening show. Also, a number of groups have come together in Hyannis to bring a drive-in theater to Main Street. They should have that open the first week in July. That's what they're hoping to do at least. And then Yarmouth Selectmen gave the go-ahead to a theater on a town-owned property on Route 28. That's been vacant for a while. That happened this week. And Martha's Vineyard Film Festival, they're also planning an outdoor series as well. And then, of course, there's the Wellfleet Drive-In,
which has already been there and waiting for everybody to come back to the idea of drive-in theaters.
Right.
So all of these new ventures, what kind of challenges are they facing in getting going?
Yeah, well, I think some have had like the physical challenge of just building theaters in time for the summer. In Sandwich, they had to take down some trees and some light poles in their parking lot just to get the screen there. But it's also money. Nantucket, this was kind of interesting. The Dreamland Theater was thinking of ways in March to stay solvent during the pandemic. They thought of the drive-in idea, but they didn't know if they could raise enough money. But then in less than a week, they raised over $150,000 with an online fundraiser. It's pretty remarkable, but I think it shows, you know, people are really looking for something to do to get out, get together, and some are happy to help fund that.
Some of the appeal of this, obviously, is the social distancing, a big part of the appeal here. But some of this must be that it represents a simpler time, yes? That the idea that we can go to the movies before there was a pandemic or something like that, there's nostalgia built into the idea of going to a drive-in movie theater.
Yeah, I wouldn't know this, Steve, but I guess in the old days, drive-in theaters were the thing to do. But a lot of theaters, yeah, they'll be playing old classics. A lot of theaters haven't released their lineups yet, but I think movies like Jurassic Park and Jaws will be big hits. And some theaters are considering some classic horror films as well. So I think that's pretty exciting to see that as well. I'll be excited to go see some of those, hopefully.
You don't remember because you're too young, you say, but I remember going to drive-in theaters when I was a boy, and even then they were kind of old-fashioned things. But they had the little speaker that you hook onto the side of your car window, say, in order to hear the sound from the movie that was being projected. But these kinds of drive-ins now are probably going to be much different because there's a whole different technology for people to be able to listen to the audio.
Yeah, I think some will be able to tune in over their radio, but others I think are going to be using kind of Bluetooth technology, which is kind of interesting. I know there are going to be different kinds of actual screens as well. Some, I think in Hyannis they're going to have like a blow-up screen, which is kind of interesting. And
like an inflatable screen. Yeah, right.
And that's going to be in the parking lot off Main Street. And some are going to be in fields. Some are going to be projected onto the actual movie theaters, like in Sandwich, which explains why it took them some work to get that going.
That is WCAI's Sam Houghton joining us to talk about drive-in theaters. Sam, thanks for that.
Thanks, Steve.
That's our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from WCAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We spoke with Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner and Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We heard from Cindy McCormick at the Cape Cod Times and Jessica Hill at the Cape Cod Times. We spoke with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette and WCAI Sam Houghton. Big thanks to Dan Tridle back at the studio for making smooth the technical obstacles before they can reach the airwaves. And to my family for playing nicely while I'm on the air and allowing me to have the biggest share of the Wi-Fi for an hour. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.